Hey guys, welcome back to this week's episode of Welcome to Group Therapy. I'm one of your hosts, licensed clinical social worker, Kristen Gingrich.
I'm licensed clinical psychologist, Dr. Kristen Casey.
And I'm licensed psychologist, Dr. Jessica Raven.
This week, we are talking all about gender diversity and gender-affirming care. So settle in, take a seat, and welcome to group therapy. So this is a really big topic in a lot of states right now. Jess, I know you have talked a lot about this on your platform. You know, it is sadly a huge topic in our political world that we are just trying to debate whether people should just have healthcare. But before we kind of dive into that, I wanted to define a couple terms that we can kind of get out there as we're talking to kind of just educate our group members, because we'll be using kind of a lot of words that maybe people may not have heard before.
Yeah, it's a great way to intro it. Jess?
I know you have definitions too.
I have definitions too.
We can go back and forth.
Yeah.
So I guess one term you're probably going to hear a lot is us using transgender or trans for short. And really that's an umbrella term for people whose gender identity or expression is different from their sex assigned at birth. So what is gender identity? What is gender expression? So gender identity really is that person's innate sense of their own gender, where gender expression is external appearances of one's gender identity. So this could be through behavior, clothing, body characteristics, voice, which may or may not be socially defined. Passing the mic to K-10 so she can define some terms.
I think it's important to talk about the difference between gender and sex. So sex is... we're born with biological characteristics. And I think a lot of people think of primary sex characteristics like the genitals and stuff like that. So usually it's either male, female, or intersex. But gender, however, is a little different. It's a social construct. And generally it's based on norms, behaviors, and societal roles expected of individuals based on primarily their sex characteristics. So chromosomes, hormones, and genitalia. So for some people, they're assigned female at birth, which I think all three of us are. I don't want to assume, but I think we are. And then for some people, they're assigned male at birth. And for some people, you know, intersex is a term to describe you might have, you know, multiple sex characteristics, and it's hard to define what your sex might be at birth. So for people who don't fall into either category, that would be that. And I think a lot of people might misconstrue sex and gender. We'll talk more about it later. But those are the two that I think are really important too.
And I also just wanted to highlight non-binary individuals because this really refers to a person who does not identify exclusively with the binary sex. So not exclusively a man or a woman. There are a lot of terms under the non-binary umbrella: agender, bigender, genderqueer, gender fluid, et cetera. I tend to use trans and non-binary unless somebody tells me their identity is different. But yeah, I think those are probably the main terms we're going to cover in today's episode. I think it's also important to acknowledge that all three of us here are cisgender women, meaning our sex assigned at birth aligns with our gender identity. We didn't mention Justin is clearly not here. He is alive to what we know, but coughing on his deathbed, if you've been following his stories at all.
You know, I showed up to this podcast unwell, and he did
you
not.
Did.
He's got the sick right now.
I know. He's probably worse off than I am, but I'm just going to chop it up to the man cold. That's what I'm going to do. And Justin, when you are editing this,
leave our friend alone. He's sick.
Before we kind of jump into, I guess, more of the meat, one question I had for you all, like, how did your grad school experience prepare you or didn't prepare you to work with gender diverse clients?
Yeah. When I think of my grad school experience, I'll be honest with you, I don't remember a lot of classes that I took relating to at least specifically working with people who are gender diverse. I don't remember a class specifically for that unless I'm blanking out for some reason. But I do know during my clinicals, like not just academic courses, when I worked at the VA and did internships and stuff, I got a lot of experience there, which was wonderful because I did not know what to do. I had no idea what I was doing. So it was really good to get, you know, training and information. But as for, in terms of classes, no, I can't remember. What about you guys?
I actually, there were classes offered in my grad program, and I ended up taking that. But I will say most of my education came from the interactions that I had with people and my own education and my own like seeking of that education. I did ended up, you know, taking a lot of trainings and being very mindful of who I took those trainings from and making sure that they were from queer folk or trans individuals or LGBTQ individuals, if it was that, like, and really, you know, having to educate myself, because it isn't in a lot of programs. If it is offered, like in my program, it was like one class.
Yeah. In grad school, we, I mean, touched on it in my cultural competency class, but nothing, you know, really formal education training. Most of my formal education training came on internship, working psychiatric inpatient, especially with adolescents. At any given time, we had at least one trans or non-binary kid on the unit. I did safe zone training then. So I got a lot of experience that year and then just continued, like KPI said, to seek out additional trainings, reading books and manuals and things like that. But yeah, grad school didn't prepare me at all.
Yeah. I always think about like what I could have learned more when I was there. And it's like drinking from a water hose, you know, when you're in grad school. But I do wish that there was more education about it. And I mean, I think even like when I think about the people who become psychologists or mental health therapists, like a lot of us have our own experiences with, you know, gender, sex stuff, all that stuff, potentially. But I do wonder, like when you're cisgender, I'll just speak for myself, I've had the privilege of never having to think about my own gender. So in my head, I just haven't had a scope in which like I would think that I would have to help someone with that. So I think grad school would have been a really nice like foot in the door of like, hey, this is an issue for people. You know, this could be something that you might have to explore in therapy. I wish there was more classes about it.
Well, and again, like what individuals came into grad school knowing? Because mm-hmm. yeah. like my upbringing, it was never talked about. It was never, I don't want to say never because it was most likely there, but it was never acknowledged. Like we didn't, like there were individuals, you know, that now are trans from my high school, but it was not confirmed in high school. And so it was never talked about. It was never brought up. It was never addressed even in my own family that it wasn't until I got to really grad school where I was like, oh wait, what is this? Yeah. And not, and like you said, like I've you know, had the privilege of never having to question those things and trying to, and like spending that time trying to understand and not, mm-hmm. and knowing that I will never understand, but how do I become a provider that is competent enough to hold a space?
Totally.
Yeah, I was thinking back to even before clinical experience when I was in my master's program was my first time really interacting, to my knowledge. Just like you said, KBI, I have friends or people from high school that later in life came out as trans, but it was my first time really interacting with individuals that were openly out. And I think, you know, now over a decade later, if I'm really going to age myself, we're talking about it more and it's more acceptable. I hate that term when it comes to this, because clearly if we were looking at all the laws and legislation, there's a large portion of people that don't believe it is. But since, just like we've talked about on this podcast so much, we're talking about mental health more, so people will talk about it more. And so I think just awareness and advocacy and learning, especially from a mental health perspective, like you know, as clinicians, this is an area that we need to be culturally aware in, because if we're thinking of the broader LGBTQ plus spectrum, we are going to have clients that are queer. And we as clinicians need to learn to be culturally aware, sensitive, and learn the unique challenges, especially as three cisgender women sitting here, because we'll never know their lived experience.
Mm-mm. No. And you make a really good point too, because I think about some of the clients I've had the privilege of working with, and a lot of them, I didn't go into providing therapeutic services for them because they were trying to explore their gender. I mean, sometimes it just kind of comes up and they're like, I've been thinking about this and I don't know if it's cool to talk about. Then I'm like, yes, let's talk, you know, because I think some people are apprehensive for very reasonable. I mean, it's very reasonable to feel apprehensive. And when you don't know if your provider can see you or understand or something like that. So I think it's really important for all of us to know. Just, you just never know if it'll pop up, you know.
I was going to say this is probably the most me question ever, but do we want to share some stats?
Can we please? Jess has to get it out of her system. Let's get some stats out there.
I need to make a compilation of all of Jess's questions that she's done over what? This is 87th episode, 86 maybe. Of just like, let's look at the stats. Let's look at the stats. Let's look at the research. Let's see what this study says and just make a compilation.
How many stats has Jess shared? Once we get to episode 100.
Listeners, if you're going through these, send us timestamps in these episodes so that I can cut them later so I don't have to listen to it.
Can you imagine we just have a whole reel of Jess just like, let's do stats.
I would cry laughing. I'm pretty sure that would cure my mental health. That would make me the most stable version of myself. And I think I need that.
Because Jess is like, whenever you talk about stats, I know it's so dry, but you're so excited and so are we. Live for it.
Because I think statistics are important. And K-10, I know you have some probably somewhere too. Yeah,
give me the stats.
I mean, I have a ton of stats. So I'll just try to like throw a few. So like in the United States, so these stats come from UCLA School of Law, Williams Institute. 1.6 million people age 13 plus identify as transgender. And the breakdown is 1.3 million adults versus 300,000 youth. What are some other fun stats? If we're looking at racial disparities, mm-hmm. it's actually pretty even across races, but for both adults and youth, American Indian and Alaska Native have the highest rates of individuals who identify as transgender.
Wow.
We don't need to define this, but Two-Spirit is a common term in American Indian and Alaska Native culture. But if you're looking from age breakdown, larger proportions of younger kids versus older. So 1.4% of 13 to 17 year olds, 1.3% of 18 to 24 year olds, 0.45% of 25 to 64 year olds, and 0.32% of 65 plus. And I think that goes to kind of what we were just talking about a few moments ago of like more people are talking about it. It's not that those 65 and older are not transgender, but if you think about it 40, 50 years ago, were they talking about it? Did they have a word for it? So I'm going to stop now and see if anybody else has stats.
Is there a stat on neurodivergence?
Because
I feel like I've read that somewhere where individuals who are neurodivergent tend to have higher numbers in gender diversity.
They do. The stat I have off the top of my head, because I knew this was going to come up and I should have written down, is specifically for autism. And it's autistic individuals are anywhere between 3 to 6 times more likely to identify as gender diverse than non-autistic individuals.
Wow.
I'm going to look that up as other people are talking, because now I feel bad that I just threw out a stat that I don't have. But it is higher. It
just
is
like I have to fact check myself. But it is. Well, I just remember reading that and thinking that was so interesting to me. That their number, like that the neurodiversity, especially autism, just was interesting. And like, what causes, like, what is, what about that makes it a larger grouping?
Yeah. And then I tend to think too, like, and this is not based on research. This is like, I'm just going off the cuff here. I do wonder if people who are neurodivergent who receive care, if they're more aware of their neurodivergence and then therefore they're potentially more aware of other things about them, like about themselves, like, the, you know, just in terms of insight and, you know, they're able to explore those things, you know, who knows? Not everybody has the opportunity for therapy or services. Again, I'm just kind of hypothesizing, but while Jess looks that up, because none of us have any stats, you know, memorized. I found a stat from 2015. I couldn't find anything more recent about veterans. I work primarily, my work is with veterans now. But it said that there was like 18% of respondents from this 2015 transgender survey in the United States. It was the largest survey examining the experience of transgender people in the United States. I think there was like 27,000 respondents. I have to go back and look. But the research showed there with that one survey that 18% of people who identified as transgender had served in the military. And I don't know exactly, I want to get more of a stat on there because it seems like a high number. But I wanted to see like your thoughts on that. If you've heard of any military, you know, people who identify as transgender, because I almost feel like it's like a taboo topic to talk about because the military and entrance and all that stuff, it's, you know, back in the day, they didn't let transgender folks into the military, you know?
I have a friend from high school, so I don't want to give too many details, but was in the military, left, came out after leaving the military. But that's my only experience, and not working with veterans, I don't know necessarily much.
It's interesting. Yeah, we'll put it in the show notes if any of these stats are wrong, by the way. So you could check the show notes just in case. But I think it's good to talk about just like prevalence rates.
And yes, the 3 to 6 times more likely was correct. It was from a 2020 study from Warrior.
Wow. She doubted herself, but she was right.
Don't doubt yourself.
Yeah, it's the largest study looking at autism and gender diversity to date. So it was 641,860 individuals.
Wow.
Interesting.
Yeah. So.
Wow. Okay, I found the VA website. It said in 2014, there were an estimated 134,000 U.S. transgender veterans with over 15,000 transgender people serving in the U.S. military, active duty or reserves. That's actually really, really cool to hear. Transgender people are 2 or 3 times more likely to have served in the U.S. military than non-transgender people. Wow.
Interesting. Interesting. You just gave me more things to look up.
Yeah, more things to think about.
Jess is like, I need to see the numbers.
This is so funny. For Jess, stats is like a little like entryway into conversation. You give her a stat and then she's like, oh my gosh, it's endless. Let's talk forever.
You should have seen my text thread with K10 earlier today. I was like looking up stats and I was like, did you know this amount? And da-da-da-da-da.
I was like, damn. Looking at my phone, I was like, oh my God, that's wild.
Yeah. If you ask Jess what gives her joy, it's her daughter, stats, her husband.
Literally, stats is up there.
Good thing he doesn't.
And you know that your husband probably would agree with me.
He would. He'd be like, yeah, research, okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
So we've definitely spent a good chunk of time talking about, you know, different gender diversity so far. What is gender affirming care?
I have a working definition. Do you want to hear it?
Yes.
Go ahead, Jess. With your
If it means that I don't have to hear another definition from Jess.
Okay. I'm going to be pseudo Jess, mini Jess, whatever. So gender affirming care is designed to support and affirm an individual's gender identity when it conflicts with the gender that they were assigned at birth. And then there's interventions for transgender folks, right? And these help people align with various aspects of their lives, emotional, interpersonal, biological, with their gender identity. And I think the APA? I'm pretty sure it was the APA. Because I can't read this. So yeah, APA. that identity could run anywhere along a continuum that includes a man, woman, combination of those, neither of those, or fluid. So depending on, you know, there's multiple definitions. And I think for some people, they might think like gender affirming care is just providing hormone treatment or just getting surgery. But I think we were talking earlier too about how gender affirming care could actually be for cisgender people too. So it's not just for transgender or non-binary or gender non-conforming or gender diverse folks.
Well, and I think that's so important because the term gender affirming care is kind of being weaponized right now in our political space and is, you know, only being used to describe the healthcare that trans or non-binary, maybe non-binary individuals are getting, when the reality is that any single person can get gender affirming care.
Absolutely. And I think people don't think about that a lot because it is tied exactly to what you said. You know, I always just describe it as it's any medical or psychosocial healthcare that affirms one's gender or gender identity, period. And that can look like a myriad of things. And I'm sure we'll get into that here shortly.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we look at, you know, gender affirming care as hormones or top surgery and things like that. But, you know, gender affirming care can be breast implants. It can be testosterone injections for males who need that. As I sit here as a cis female, I can't name our hormones at the moment. What are our hormones?
Estrogen. You're doing great. You're sick. You're doing so good today. Like, I just want to highlight. You're doing great.
I'm like, I don't know what my hormones are.
What are my hormones?
But like, I could go.
I just want that to be a clip. Sorry. What are my hormones?
What are my hormones?
God. But that's the thing is like, you know, especially I've seen middle-aged women who have estrogen get estrogen injections. That is gender care. Mm-hmm. That is something that your body is not making, or you need more assistance. But we only seem to want to look at the term gender affirming care when it comes to LGBTQ trans individuals. Now, I think that sometimes, you know, that is in our political space right now because there are a lot of bills being passed to help limit this. Not help, but like they're thinking they're helping. They're not helping.
The intention is to eliminate. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They think they're helping. They're being McAssholes. being trying to put it nicely on a podcast. I have much colorful words that I could say, but I'll refrain. But yeah, like we only want to focus on that. And, you know, they want to do things like ban gender affirming care, but you ask them, "Oh, are you going to ban breast implants for cis women?" Absolutely not. That's plastic surgery. Mm-hmm. Get the fuck out of here.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think, I mean, you all have also brought this up, but I think it's important to talk about that. People think gender affirming care is hormones and surgery. Mm-hmm. Like, and that's it. Puberty blockers as well. And because that's what's in the media. That's the misinformation spread. That's how, you know, the false information and narratives about like young kids getting surgery and everything mm-hmm. starts. But like gender affirming care is so much more than puberty blockers, hormones, and surgery. And medical intervention, which all three of those are, for gender affirming care is not step one. It's usually not even step two or three. It's not a fast process. And any trans, non-binary individual who has received any medical intervention for gender-affirming care will tell you it's a process.
Yeah.
It's not like one day they go to the doctor and like, "Hey, I'm trans," and the doctor's like, "Great, let me just refer you to a surgeon." Like, that's not how it's mm-hmm. happening.
Totally. There's so many hoops and barriers. And I do gender affirming surgery evaluations. And I feel like every time I try to advocate for my client, and depending on the state, sometimes I'm limited. what the policy is going on right now. It's really, really tough. I'm fighting back anyway. I don't care. I don't give a shit. I'm just like, let's roll. Fuck it. You know,
get fucked.
Let's go. Yeah. But I do think that, like, you know, for some of the clients that I work with who are wanting, you know, implants or something like that, just for themselves, like for people who are cisgender, they don't have to get letters. They don't have to, mm-hmm. you know, get approval. They don't have to think about the emotional or mental consequences post-surgery. Like, nobody's talking to cisgender women about this, unless I don't know. I mean, I think surgeons do a great job of informing people about potentially the consequences and risks and benefits. That's their job. But I do think that transgender and gender nonconforming individuals are treated way differently in the same sphere as cisgender mm-hmm. women. And it's very obvious. Very obvious.
Mm-hmm. Well, mm-hmm. as someone who would like breast implants, I would love breast implants. That is my, that's my goal I'm working towards. That's gender affirming care because I would like them. Mm-hmm. I don't, I have to go for a consultation. I don't have to go for an evaluation. I don't have to go. And that, and I understand that that is a privilege because it's a financial privilege to even get to those places. And how frustrating that is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even just even how frustrating it is to have the right pronouns on your medical documentation.
Oh my gosh. Don't get me started.
I remember at my old job, we're a shit talk for a minute. I remember advocating in our intake paperwork because it said gender. And I advocated and advocated for months saying, you want to claim to be trauma informed, yet we don't have a box for sex and gender. You just lump it into gender. There is no box for preferred name. And, you know, it's hard because, you know, billing insurance, at times we have to use a legal name, whether or not it's your preferred name on certain documentation. Mm-hmm. But you can make gender affirming care more accessible just by putting a preferred name. And I asked, when I did intakes, I asked every person, what's your preferred name? So Nicholas, do you want to be called Nick? Mm-hmm. Put Nick mm-hmm. in there. Oh, you're Franklin? Oh, your actual name is Susan? Okay, let me put that in. Hi, Susan. Nice to meet you. Like, it's small things like that that are also considered gender affirming care. And it starts at those small things. It starts when you go into a doctor's office and you fill out the paperwork and you write down mm-hmm. your pronouns, you write down your preferred name, and they address you as so.
Like, and I always try to tell people, like, if you're a cisgender, like, we're all cisgender women here, right? Like, just say you walk into any establishment, doctor's office, grocery store, like anywhere, and somebody refers to you as he, you're going to feel some sort of way, you know? You're going to be like, whoa, do you see me? You know, like, that's not my pronouns, you know? You're going to feel some sort of way. So I always try to say, like, when people are like about the pronoun thing, like, oh my gosh, like, why does it matter? Because it does. Like, it just does. And it matters for cisgender people too. You know, it doesn't mm-hmm. matter just for transgender or gender nonconforming or non-binary folks. It really, I know that you'll feel some sort of way if somebody misgenders you, even if you're cis, you know? So I think that on top of, you know, if you think about what the experience might be like for people who have had to, you know, fight their way to be seen in a way that they're hoping to be seen in and perceived in a way that they're hoping to align with their identity. I mean, that is a really, really hard place to be, you know? So for people out there who might not understand and say, oh, it's not a big deal, it might not be a big deal to you. Maybe it's like a minor deal for you. You're just like, oh, I don't know if I would like that. But for someone who's questioned and dealt with this their whole life, it is a big deal. It is a big deal, mm-hmm. you know? So to KBI's point, I think when we're thinking about names and stuff like that, when people say, oh, this is my name, I don't even register. I'm just like, that's your name. Cool. Mm-hmm. That's your name. That's it. No question. It's your name. That's it.
As you all were talking about names, I was literally sitting here and I'm like, okay, my little box says Jess. That's not my legal name. I mean, it's Jessica. K10 and KBI. Nobody has ever been like, I'm not going to call you that because that's not your legal name. Mm-hmm. Or like Dr. J. I mean, we call him Justin too. But like when it comes to cis people, we don't question. Like, I live in the South. We have like William Allen Schmidtheimer the 14th and they go by, you know,
goes by Dick.
Gary. And you're like, what? But that's what they've been. So when it comes to like cis people, we don't even question.
No.
Some, and I always think about, especially as somebody that works with minors, like, you know, step one, psychoeducation, like for the client, for the family, if family is involved, like what are terms? What are different options for transition? What are risks and benefits? What are resources available to individuals? Like, you know, are there referrals to specialists that need to be made? And psychoeducation is always ongoing. But like, that's step number one, just like for any mental health or healthcare. And then we think of like social transition. So, you know, we've just been talking about name and pronouns. Maybe, you know, as mental health providers, we might provide a safe space where someone can explore their gender identity, try out new ways of expressing themselves in therapy, because that's a safe space. Maybe it's new clothing or hairstyles or makeup or engagement in activities that are more congruent with their gender identity. Like social transition, 100% reversible. Hair grows back. You can buy new clothes, like all those types of things. But like people jump to puberty blockers, hormones. But all of these steps are part of gender affirming care. And, you know, us as mental health professionals or medical professionals that are providing this care, it's supporting our clients in their transition. It's providing that psychoeducation. It's, you know, exactly like you all both said, using the correct name and pronouns, you know, listening to their lived experiences.
Oh, yeah, totally. And I think there might be another misconception. I'm not a transgender person, so I might not fully understand the scope of this. But to my knowledge, to transition, you don't have to get any surgery if you don't want to. I mean, it doesn't make you any more or less valid in your identity, your gender identity, you know? And I think that there's like, I know we were talking about, you know, the surgery before, the WPATH standards of care for individuals who are going through this process, they've actually done really great in version 8. We're at version 8 now of the standards. The first standards came out in 1979. We've come a long way, 8 different versions now. But I think that I was reading in there that they're suggesting that providers actually not require people to go through therapy and to go through all of these different, you know, hoops and hoops that they have to go through to get surgery, and to just leave it down to like one evaluation, a single evaluation, to reduce barriers for this population. So when people say like, oh, you know, like there are barriers, there still is a barrier. You still have to go through an evaluation, a psych evaluation. That's not fun. Nobody loves seeing psych anyway. Like who does, you know what I mean? Like for an evaluation, like I wouldn't, you know, I'd be like, gosh, I have to get psychologically evaluated to get a surgery. Like it doesn't make any sense, right? So I do think that there are things working in our favor in this sense, but there are policies again that are, you know, it almost feels like it's kind of balancing out in a way with what's going on. But I did want to acknowledge that. I forgot to mention that before. That version 8, like we're really trying to make it easier for people who are going through this process. And as a provider who does this, I try to make it as easy as possible. I'm like, let me send the letter. Let me talk to your surgeon. Let me do all the legwork for you because it's like probably stressful, you know?
And one of my, like my favorite thing about this laced with sarcasm is I hear this common phrase is like people, we want people to go through this because we don't want them to regret their choice. Mm. And I'm like, What if they do? What if they start to transition at 18 or things like that? And when they turn 28, they're like, oops, I made a mistake. Guess who that impacts? Not you. It impacts that person. And I know that that number is very low. I know that there are individuals who have detransitioned. Absolutely. But I know that that number is pretty low. Jess is probably searching the number right now, but it's like, and it's the people who say these things who have no dice in the game. They're like, they're caring about what strangers are doing with their personal life. And it just blows my mind. I'm like, what if?
I know.
Mm-hmm. What, like.
So that was an actual stat I know off the top of my head. Surgical regret for trans individuals is less than 1%. I was trying to find the study. So it was a 2021 systematic review. So that specific surgical regret. For comparison, bringing back to, you know, what KBI you were saying earlier about like breast reconstruction surgery, a 2013 study that found that 40% of cis women who got implants regretted their decision. And, you know, people will throw out, there was this study, I have it somewhere, that was done in 2013 by Steensma and colleagues that people will quote a lot because it said it's on children. And it's like 63% desisted, which means grew out of their gender diversity by 15 or 16. It was only 127 kids. Of the 127, 38 didn't actually meet criteria for gender dysphoria. So they were sub-threshold, but they accounted for that. They also included – said that anybody that didn't return to their clinic, which was 28 participants – meant that they no longer were gender diverse. So right there, we have 64 of the 127 that either didn't meet criteria or just didn't follow up, and it's included in that 63%. So there was a lot of issues with the methodology of that study. And the other thing I tell people, gender expression and exploration in childhood is normal. It's a normal part of childhood development. And you know, yes, some young children absolutely know they are transgender. In my experience, and this is me talking as a clinician that works with trans and non-binary youth, most truly realize around puberty. Mm-hmm. They may have like known, okay, I don't feel this way, but it's when there's secondary sex characteristics develop. So yeah, if you are looking at six-year-olds and you have, you know, Susie who's a tomboy and likes boy things and maybe says, I'm a boy, but then hits puberty and is like, no, I wasn't. Like, but at 6 years old, no child is getting any medical intervention. No. You can't get medical intervention until you've gone through puberty and are in Tanner stage two. You cannot get puberty blockers before then. So I'm going to stop ranting.
Yeah. You make such good points, because I even think, and I like to expand the scope too of like, gender expression, and I could even speak for myself as like a cisgender woman, like I don't wear pink. I don't like girly things. Like I just don't. Like I just don't. I don't fall into the paradigm of like the stereotypical gender expression of a typical cisgender woman, right? So I think like it could expand, you know? And then I think about people who are gender fluid, gender nonconforming, non-binary folks. I mean, what does it mean for them? You know, it could be anything. To Jess's point too, I think you have like an all-knowing at a certain point in your life of like, do I fit into this category or not? You know? But I think trusting in the human intuition and the human experience, like you're the expert on your life and your identity too. And trusting when people say, I don't know if I fit into this category. Okay. Like, why are we questioning that? You know? It makes me wonder why other people think that they're the experts in other people's lives, especially when it comes to gender expression, gender identity, even gender roles. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I mean, we haven't even really talked about like femininity and masculinity, but those mm-hmm. are even different constructs yeah. from gender. And mm-hmm. there's so much nuance. And, you know, exactly like you both have been saying, why, to put it bluntly, like, why do people care so much? Like KBI, if you were to get breast implants, I would be like, good for you, girl. I have no that has no bearing on my life at all, other than we're really good friends, so maybe you would like text me and be like, but like but if you were like somebody rant, like that has no bearing on my life. And that's what I think about. And I know this is really close to me right now, given everything going on in my state as a provider, that it's going to impact if it passes. But like, why do people care? so much. If it's not directly impacting your life, like, you know, trans people deserve to exist. They deserve to have equitable health, medical, mental health care. They deserve to live. Like, I mean, and the thing that I'm pausing because it sounds ridiculous coming out of my mouth that I have to say these things to me.
You know, I'm glad that you're saying it though, because I think that people misunderstand what they don't, they get upset about things they don't understand, you know? So I do think a lot of it is misinformation or fixed belief systems or confirmation bias. You know, I think honestly, a lot of it is that, because when I meet people who are trans, like I have nothing but great experience. Like I can't even name I can't even pull from my memory like a negative experience I've had anywhere in a bathroom setting, in a professional setting, in a personal, like I've just never had an experience in which I was fearful of this person, you know? But if I was to listen to other people who were like, oh my gosh, like spilling all this misinformation, maybe I would be a little fearful. Maybe I'd be like, oh, a little guarded, right? Or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really important to be very informed and remain really objective when it comes to these things. Like all the stats are there, all of the research is there, and transgender people and gender nonconforming people aren't violent. They're not mean humans. Like they're great people from my understanding and my experiences. But I think there are people out there who might think like, oh, we have to put a ban on this because we don't know what it'll do to, you know, our society or other people or children or something like that. But I just can't imagine a world in which somebody who's transgender is doing that specifically for taking advantage of other people. It's such a big experience to go through. There's just so much to it that I can't imagine that being the cause, you know?
And like, you always get the people who are like, well, what if someone pretends? So what if there's a dude who pretends to be a woman to go into the women's bathroom? That's a whole other issue. That's not this issue. That's a whole other situation.
That's a cis man issue, I guess.
Yeah. And I will say one of my favorite things to do is like, if I'm getting into discourse with someone around this, and it's one of my favorite things to say, and like when they start spewing bullshit, is I'll be like, wow, you're really focused on a stranger's genitals. That's kind of weird. I'm like, that's kind of weird. And they're like, no, no. And I'm like, I mean, you are though. Like, and it's just so, it's so dumb. It's so like the amount of effort that people put into trying to control what other people do in their private life.
Yeah, I think that's the hard part, because I don't know. I think that anybody, whether you're trans or not, you have private experiences in your life that you just don't share with other people. All of us do. Mm-hmm. We have private lives, private thoughts, private experiences, things like that. Yep. You know, we have secrets. And I think for people who are out and they're trans or they're non-binary, that takes a lot of courage in a world that is stacked against you. There's people out there who don't see you as human, or they don't see you as like deserving of being here, like Jess was saying. And I just hope if there's anybody listening that, you know, you see this podcast as a safe place. I know that we can't say it's a safe place unless you do, but I think all of us here are for transgender rights, you know?
Yeah. I really have no follow-up on that. That was really...
Yeah, I needed to say it. I was like, when am I going to say it? Get it out.
You know what else we're here for? The polls. Ooh. Is that the polls?
No, it's the Google Scholar Shorts. Try again. It's okay. We can She's be here sick. For the polls too.
She's sick. Give her a free pass. It's okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I at least showed up to the podcast. Now I'm going to blow my nose.
So I obviously was excited to find an article for this, and I was trying to find something that was just not filled with stats and for you all. So I'm pulling from a little Dr. Haji last week and merging about transgender individuals and prison. So this study came from 2024 in Australia and New Zealand.
We've only been in- We haven't even been in it for, we're just a little over 3 weeks and this bitch is pulling out brand new research.
Brand spanking new, right up.
Hot off the motherfucking press.
Yep, yep. So we're thinking Australia and New Zealand, which I don't think Dr. Haji talked about the prison systems there, but how well do you think policies for transgender individuals in Australia and New Zealand prisons align with human rights standards, regards to things like placement, use of name and pronouns, gender expression, access to gender affirming care? Like, if you're envisioning prisons,
it's going to be one or the other. It's going to be like super, super fucking great or super fucking terrible. I'm going to err on the side of super great because New Zealand is great.
I visited Australia and I want to say it's great, but I don't know based on my own personal experience, but the people there are nice. So I'm just going to say good. Like, it's better.
Yeah. So I'm just going to read off a lot of information because there's a lot of good information in this. Mm-hmm. So it was a systematic search done on the Public Adult Corrections Service websites in each of the Australian state territories in New Zealand. So there's 9 different ones. So all 9 have different standards. So with regard to placement, so for trans individuals being placed in prisons based on their gender identity rather than sex assigned at birth, the Australian Capital Territory, New South Wales, Northern Territory, Tasmanian, and Victorian policies all included a principle that trans people should be accommodated in a prison according to their gender identity unless there are overriding safety or security concerns. Victoria noted initial placement according to legal documentation from the courts within, and it would be reviewed within 3 days. So Victoria, you get placed based on your sex assigned at birth, but within 3 days. So I thought that was really good. There's more information on that, but I was like, okay, we're starting out good. With regard to name and pronouns, all jurisdictions had policies requiring staff to use a trans person's name and pronouns, and all except Queensland required documentation of these details in the electronic medical record. With regard
take notes,
to gender,
take some notes, America.
With regard to gender affirming clothing and grooming items, only Australian Capital Territory, New South Wales, New Zealand, and Western Australia policies stated that trans people would be provided with appropriate clothing and underwear to align their appearance with their gender identity. So we started off strong. Now we're kind of getting murky. And then with regard to gender-affirming healthcare, New South Wales, New Zealand, Tasmanian, and Western Australian policies stated trans people would have access to gender-affirming treatment in prisons as the same as it would be in the community. In Southern Australia, trans people can access hormone therapy through the prison health services, but requests for gender-affirming surgery would be considered for only those with at least 5-year non-parole period. In Northern Territory, gender-affirming surgery requests depend on the sentence length and good order of the institution. And then Victorian policy stated that trans people may access gender-affirming treatment through prison health services. So overall, New South Wales and Victorian policies had the highest concordance with human rights standards, while Queensland and South Australian policies had the lowest.
I gotta unmute myself. That's wild. We did start off strong and then it got murky. You're right. Yeah. I was like so hyped up and then I was like, oh shit. Yeah. Okay. Back to reality. You know what I mean? Like,
I feel like, you know, the access to gender affirming care, like in at least 4 of the places was good. But yeah, I mean, I thought it was just an interesting study one because I, as we learned last week, none of us know really anything about prison. But, you know, it was also something that I was not familiar with. And I think, you know, last week I brought up the article about elderly in prison. And I would imagine trans individuals is not a population that is considered a lot in prison settings.
I'm looking up.
I'm
looking up one of the stats that I put on the polls because I can't remember exactly what the answer was. And I
– Oh, I was going to – I had a transition for a second, but now I don't remember. what it was. So we'll just wait till K10 pulls up the polls. Yay, polls.
Give me a second.
Yay, polls.
I am going to guess, and then I'm going to put in the show notes. Okay, ready?
The Sudafed is hitting.
Sudafed pumped through my veins. Okay, so I did the polls. This was so fun because I like to test you guys like it's a standardized test. So the first one was about...
It's a psychologist in her.
It's so good. I love it. I love a good quiz. Okay. So about blank percent of U.S. adults identify as transgender or gender nonconforming. This translates roughly to 4.6 million individuals. 2.4, 1.4, 1.3, or 3.2. What do you guys think? U.S. adults who are transgender or gender nonconforming in the United States.
It's so one of those. 3,
or did I make that up?
Say it again.
Was that an even an option?
What?
1.3?
Yeah. Yeah, 2.4, 1.4, 1.3, or 3.2.
Oh, but you said 1.4 or 1.3. You sneaky little.
I'm a sneaky snake. Yeah.
She's a snake. A snake.
What translates to 4.6 million individuals? Because I forgot what the answer was.
I think it's 1.3 or 1.4, but I think you forgot what the answer was.
I think it's 1.4, but I don't know for sure because that's the one I didn't highlight in my notes because I can't find my notes.
Yeah, I think it's 1.4.
Okay.
She's a real doctor, y'all.
I don't know who gave
with
me a doctor.
With a big old doctor degree.
Y'all got it right. 35% of our listeners. I'm just going to trust them on this
one.
We
think you got it right.
We think. Okay. Transgender youth are blank times more likely to experience suicidal ideation than their cisgender peers. And access to gender-affirming care has been shown to significantly reduce this risk. So how many – so two times, three times, or four times more likely to experience suicidal ideation than cisgender?
I feel like I should know this off of the top of my head. And for some reason
– Jess is just being nice to us. Okay, KB,
I think it's three.
Do you think it's three? Okay. Yeah. It's actually four times more likely.
Yeah.
67% of our group members got it. They're so smart. Like, I don't even know why we do the polls anymore. 2023 saw a rise in anti-trans legislation, especially targeting gender-affirming care for minors. Over blank bills restricting access were introduced across states. 60 bills, 100 bills, 160 bills, or 270 bills.
Probably 270 because our country sucks.
It's actually 160.
Oh, is that anti-trans for youth?
And 2023 saw a rise in anti-trans legislation. Yeah, for minors.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then two more. So blank individuals make up 11% of the LGBT community. Transgender, gender fluid, non-binary, or pansexual.
I'm going to say this is a trick.
Trans.
And say transgender since we're talking about
it's actually non-binary. Our group listeners got it right, they literally got it right. I had to look these up. They were hard. Okay, and then this one's a little bit of an easier one. Studies consistently show mental health improvements for individuals receiving gender-affirming care. This reduces anxiety, depression, and gender dysphoria. True, false, or you know, I know this. Quit playing.
Quit playing.
Yeah,
you know, I know this.
It's true. Yeah, it's true. Thanks for doing the polls, y'all. I love that you guys don't care that I test you guys a lot, but I do need to make them a little easier because I even forget and then I'm fucked for the polls. So
how do you not pre-write them out in your notes section?
So I was telling Jess before, I had an entire Word doc with all my stuff and I can't find it. So that's the one that I can't remember off the top of my head. So it's my bad. The nail emoji. Yeah.
And K10, before we move on to the questions, I wanted to highlight that last one because we're a mental health podcast and we didn't really talk about like mental health trans individuals. But we do know like research has shown consistently higher rates of like depression, anxiety, suicidality in LGBTQ+ individuals in general, but especially trans and non-binary. But over and over again, the research shows it's not to do with being innately trans or non-binary. It's to do with stigma, discrimination, harassment, things like that. And exactly like you said, gender-affirming care acceptance, social support for youth, things like having a school that's affirming, having parents that are affirming, reduce those risks. So I just wanted to add that because as you were saying that, I was like, we did not mention mental health once in the almost hour we've been talking.
Maybe the group member questions might get us there.
Yeah. So we're bad at transitions tonight. So let's get into the group member questions. We got so many good ones. Hopefully we can get through a bunch of them. I know we talk a lot, but thank you all for submitting as always. And I appreciate many of you being like very vulnerable and open and asking questions that maybe you don't feel comfortable asking, like friends or colleagues or things like that. So first question from Milo from Maine just asked, how much experience do each of you have with working with trans or non-binary people?
I was going to say, I have a small experience. I wouldn't say that I have like, you know, it was like a focus. There was a period of time where a large chunk of my caseload was trans non-binary youth emerging adults. And that's when I really truly had to like dive into the education of it to make sure that I was providing effective care in that way. But yeah, I wouldn't say like it was definitely not like a major, major focus, but there were periods in my work where more of my clientele leaned more into that than not.
Nice. Yeah, when I was at during my internship at the VA, I co-facilitated a transgender support group, and that's kind of where I started with the whole thing. And then I was providing services for transgender veterans. And then now I do gender-confirming surgery or affirming surgery evaluations in my private practice. And then I also have a lot of clients who are either non-binary or trans. And we talk a lot about like, you know, anxiety, depression, mental health. So I have a good amount of experience, but that's not like my primary caseload. I would say that it's a good majority of my caseload, but it's not like the primary focus. Mm-hmm. Jess, what about you?
So I cheated since I'm doing the questions and I actually went through all my clients today to see. So 1/3 of my clients that I currently have outpatient are trans or non-binary.
Nice.
And then like UK10, but different because I primarily work with youth. I will also do like hormone or puberty blocker evaluations. So that's more of a one-time, maybe two-time thing. So I would say consistently my outpatient caseload is at least like 50% LGBTQ plus and mm-hmm. consistently about 1/3 trans non-binary. So Isabella from Ontario, Canada asks, how do you all support those who are transitioning or contemplating the transition? Have you supported those who transitioned before?
Yeah, if I'm thinking in a professional sense, it looks a little different if I have a friend. But in a professional sense, I create an open space to talk about it. And I ask them too, like I'll ask a client, like, how comfortable do you feel talking to me about this? You know, is this something that you want to talk to me about or would another provider be better? You know, I always offer that. And I always say, no strings attached. You won't hurt my feelings. Like, it's totally cool because it's such a sensitive topic that requires a lot of trust, you know? So I always start with that, make sure they feel comfortable enough to talk with me about it. And then really it's kind of like an exploration, you know, and it depends on the client, depends on what they need. So for clients who are really, really looking for surgery, that support looks different than a client who says like, I'm just now starting to think about it, you know? So it just, you know, the treatment might look very different, but I guess the overall vibe that I try to put out there is, and it's true, it comes authentically, like whatever you're going to tell me, I believe you, you know, whatever mm-hmm. your lived experience is, I believe you. So don't worry about trying to convince me. Don't worry about trying to educate me. Try to see this as like your space to take up space and talk about this and let me show up for you as well. So vague answer, but that's kind of how I do it. What about you guys?
Mm-hmm. I do a lot of just meeting every one of the clients that I worked with, like where they were at mm-hmm. in their journey. I mean, there was a period of time where I was the only person that knew. And in my office, you know, using correct name, correct pronouns, all of that outside of my office, using incorrect names and incorrect pronouns, because that's what they needed. And because at the end of the day, it's not about me. It's about what makes them feel safe. And so it was a lot of just meeting everybody where they were at in their journey, whether it was, for, you know, they've started the process, they were pondering, they were in the midst. I facilitated conversations and like facilitated, you know, teens talking with their parents and coming out to their parents and wanting to have like a safe space to do that. Not that I was the one giving that, but like kind of just creating that safe space. But yeah, that's what I wanted to do, was just always meet them in that kind of unconditional positive regard.
So important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, similar to everything that you all said, specific to youth, a lot of psychoeducation, like I said earlier, not only for them, but the families. I've done a lot of like parent sessions on how parents can best support their child, really providing that safe space. You know, I can think of some youth, and I'm in a unique position that I would say most of my trans and non-binary or gender non-conforming clients are referred to me specifically because they know I'm like provide gender affirming care in a state that doesn't have a lot of providers, or like they've come out to their primary care doctor and like are seeking mental health care. So it's usually a reason they are seeking care. And I can think of, you know, times that we're just trying out different names, or like I mentioned earlier, I can think of a past client that really used our therapy sessions for, you know, exploring gender expression. So she may wear wigs, or we would try makeup or things in just like a safe space. Mm-hmm. So exactly what KBI said, meeting them where they're at, supporting them, listening to their experiences, and then, you know, depending on what their goals for transition are, letter writing, referring them to specialists, things like that. So Cameron asked a really good question, and K10, not to punt to you, but I'm going to punt to you. Cameron from Michigan asked, can any therapist write a letter stating gender-affirming care is necessary as it is required in a lot of places, or does it have to be someone who specializes in that?
It's a really good question. Really, really good question. And I don't know what it's like for master's level folks, so I'll just kind of say that off the jump. I kind of know it from a psychologist perspective. But to my knowledge, I don't know if there's any specific trainings that people have to go through or something like that. I've gotten a lot of training on this just because it's what I do for evaluation, so I want to know as much as I possibly can. But I could talk about the standards of care for transgender and gender diverse people, and maybe the standards in which, you know, it's basically the WPATH recommendations. I think they have a bunch of recommendations for people writing these letters, so I could just kind of briefly touch on some of them. So the first one is, you know, we recommend that mental health professionals address the symptoms that interfere with the person's capacity to consent to gender-affirming care. So basically, if you're a therapist and you're writing a letter for this, I would suggest getting supervision on it. I would suggest getting training, and I would definitely suggest getting consultation if it's your first couple of times writing these letters, because there's a lot of specific things to include in the letter. And it's really important to notice that these letters are definitely supposed to help the person get the care that they need. And if there are things in there that might impact their ability, of course, like you want to highlight those. But I think that there's a lot to know. So we could even link in the notes as well, even just the manual that people might use to write these letters. But the long and short of it is, I don't know if there's any specifications, but I do know you have to at least be a master's level clinician with a license to practice. And I would assume and hope that somebody has had training in this area, you know, about either providing gender affirming surgery evaluations, or, you know, observing one done or at least reading a letter, just to make sure. I know that we're trying to reduce barriers and see it as like a one-time evaluation and stuff like that. But I do think it's really important to be informed. So I don't know if there's, and Jess, you might be able to say more. I could talk about the specifications, but in terms of like therapists in general for master's level, I don't know. But psychologists, I know that we have some training that we could go through.
Well, since I'm the only one with a master's degree, I don't really know. The only letter I've only written one letter, and it was to help insurance cover the surgery. Oh, yeah. And so that would be the only thing. And it required, like, I did a ton of research. I did a ton of supervision around it. I do know that a lot of medical providers, like when I look at a lot of our insurance paperwork here and things like that, it is an MD, a PhD, or an LCSW. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, like just the way that our state is, LCPCs or conditionally licensed folks can't sign off on those things. But yeah, that's just, again, specific to Maine.
Yeah. I didn't go through any like, I got supervision consultation, mm-hmm. For letter writing. There's not formal training. Looked at the standards of care, kind of out of a like assessment process I go through. Yeah. My jaded self when I read this, like, can any therapist write a letter? Yes. Should any therapist write a letter? Probably. Not because especially for – and K-10, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this because I've written very few surgery letters because mm-hmm. I don't often see people under 18. Mm-hmm. There are specific requirements that surgeons need.
It's very specific. Yeah.
So if you don't know what those requirements are, the letter is probably not going to – go very far. But most of my letters have been about like initiation of hormones or puberty blockers, things like that. And that's more just to have, capacity to consent, understanding risk benefits, assessment of any mental health conditions that may interfere with adherence, compliance, things like that.
I think you make really good points though, because I think that it's not necessarily that you need to take like a class or something like that. It's more about being really informed about the new standards, you know, as it mm-hmm. relates to, you know, the what's not required in the letters, but like what's the updated stats for the standard of care. And for example, like in volume eight, I can't think of the word. I feel like KBI sickness is transferring to me telepathically.
Version 8? It's standard of care version 8, the WPATH.
Version 8, thank you, yeah. So now I'm pretty sure one modification is you only need one letter from a provider, whereas there was like multiple that you would need, and then they lowered the requirements for hormone treatment before surgical interventions. And then I'm pretty sure they also removed requirements of living in your desired gender role too. So it's like there's a little bit of change there. And, you know, you don't have to go through psychotherapy for like a certain amount of time either before the evaluation. I mean, you can, you know, why not? But you don't have to. So I think in terms of therapists writing letters, it's just important to be informed about what's actually required, because you might say like, hey, you need therapy. And then the client is having to do therapy and that's costly. And what if they don't have a therapist that, you know, could provide, what if their insurance does it, like all these things, you know, to consider. So you might actually make it easier for the client if you are just informed on like the updated standards. That's all.
Absolutely. So we have two questions that I'm just going to kind of lump together to have a discussion, because I feel like we started this discussion, but could expand more. So Anubis from Germany says, what is the standard procedure to get gender affirming care in the US? Do you have to get a diagnosis like gender dysphoria to be able to access it, etc.? And if you think it could be better, what or how would you change it? And then Christine from Texas asks, what is the spectrum of gender affirming care from most simple to least invasive procedures? And I mean, I can take this and you all can jump in. So step one, psychoeducation. Like, and you don't, to go to Anubis's question, like you don't have to have a diagnosis of gender dysphoria to get psychoeducation on certain terms, options for transition, things like that. Assisting with social transition is usually like a second step. And I'm kind of saying this in steps, but it's not really stepwise. But psychoeducation, social transition typically are the first couple things that people will go through. As for medical intervention, at least if you're billing insurance and you have insurance that will cover gender-affirming care, because not all insurance in the United States does, you do need a diagnosis of gender dysphoria to receive medical gender-affirming care, at least in South Carolina. So puberty blockers may be the first step. You have to be in Tanner stage 2 for puberty. This is to suppress puberty. Not a large majority of individuals would go on puberty blockers unless they are transitioning at a younger age. Obviously, there's hormones, so testosterone, estrogen. So typically, if it's a child, and by child, I mean adolescent, because prepubescent children do not get any medical intervention, they may do puberty blockers before hormones or estrogen. And so estrogen, testosterone, like we already said, you don't have to get any medical intervention. During this time, people may engage in like general tucking, packing, binding, padding. So these are all reversible interventions. So general tucking is exactly what it sounds like. You wear special underwear to tuck the penis. Packing would be the opposite, like a silicone penis. Binding your chest, padding your chest, padding your hip thighs, just to make your body more aligned with your gender identity. Obviously, there's surgeries. There's top surgery, so for trans men, removal of breasts. Trans women, they may get breast implants, genital surgery, but there's other types of surgeries too, like a hysterectomy, facial feminizing surgery, tracheal cartilage shave, other implants in different parts of your body, voice surgery. And once again, not a stepwise process. Typically, though, surgery would be after hormones. Like K10 just said, there used to be requirements. They're getting rid of it. And I have actually worked with one individual off the top of my head that couldn't be on hormones for a medical reason. And so like there's always exceptions. But I always also like to bring up things outside of the typical hormone surgery, things like that. Like birth control is gender affirming. So yeah. For individuals assigned female at birth who no longer desire to have a period, whether they're transmasculine, non-binary, birth control that stops their period is gender affirming. Laser hair removal is gender affirming. Yep. Voice modification through speech therapy is gender affirming. Fertility preservation is gender affirming care. And there's not necessarily like a stepwise process. Not everybody does any or most of these. So, and then obviously mental health care, which is ongoing through that. So like to go to Christine's question, like spectrum, most simple to least invasive. Like I think we would all argue that surgery is probably the most invasive, but it's not necessarily like a stepwise process.
I think, I'm with you. I think it depends on like if we're thinking about the amount of time or effort or money or recovery or something like that, sure. Surgery would be probably the more invasive. And Jess, that was such a great list because I'm thinking – I was thinking of voice training. I was also thinking of like there's so many different types of top and bottom surgeries, you know, especially depending on if you're assigned male at birth, assigned female at birth, like vulvoplasty, vaginoplasty. Like there's all these different surgeries that you could get. And I think that there's a lot that goes into it. But I think that the spectrum of it, I think in the beginning, if you think about like – I'm putting it in air quotes, like, you know, if you were to do like laser hair removal – technically, that's gender affirming for a secondary sex characteristic like body hair. Cis women could get that too, right? Anybody could technically get that. But when you think about the more invasive surgeries, I mean, it just requires more time and effort and all that stuff.
So Sam from Connecticut asks, Aside from switching PCPs, how do I go about telling my doctor that I'm transmasculine after I've already told them and I'm still being treated as a cis woman and having anxiety about speaking up? First, Sam, I want to say I'm sorry.
I know
that that's happening to you. That's not to be an excuse for physicians by any means, but as somebody that works in a hospital, and I can't speak to the training everywhere, unfortunately, gender affirming care is not standard part. Like we all talked about at the beginning in our graduate mm-hmm. programs, not that that's an excuse by any means. And I'm hoping that changes, but it's not a standard part of care. So first, I just wanted to offer condolences that you're being non-affirmed when you go to the doctor.
Yeah. And I think we even talked about too, like in our training, like we didn't even have any classes, right?
Yeah.
So I think we get a lot of our training as we go, you know, and of course, if we specialize, then it's different. And yeah, I also want to say like, I'm so sorry you're experiencing that. That's so hard. I think it really depends on like any case. It would depend on how safe you feel to discuss this with your primary care. I mean, I think safety is something that you have to assess, especially if you're in a medical setting. Because even if you were to just say voice these things, you don't really know how you might be treated, or you don't really know what their response might be. So I think assessing safety is important. Just say the scene is safe. Just say you feel good, and just say this primary care physician is somebody that you trust. I mean, given what you just told us, I don't think that you do, but just say you do. Just say, you know, you might gently correct them, see how they take it. I think it is all like kind of testing them in a way, not in a malicious way by any means, but kind of just testing the boundaries and kind of seeing like, did they just not hear me, you know, or something like that. But, you know, even if you've already told them and you're still being treated that way, I would wonder if this primary care physician is competent to treat you and your mm-hmm. gender concerns. You know, that's just one thing I think about. I always go back to like, not necessarily like they're a bad physician. That's not really it. It's more so, are they like aware? Are they informed? Are they able and willing and wanting to treat you in this way? You know what I mean? So I think that's all things to consider.
Mm-hmm. I definitely agree with that. And my only additional thought, because Sam, I know you said you have some anxiety about speaking up. I don't know what your healthcare system uses, if you use MyChart or anything like that, but there are some capabilities to like send a message to your physician like ahead of time if writing it out seems to be less anxiety provoking than speaking up, or changing your name and pronouns and stuff in your MyChart. So like I know for us, obviously we have the legal name that is related to insurance, but there's also option for what the person likes to be called, regardless of if they're cis or trans. So that might be another avenue if you do feel like you trust this person otherwise, or maybe you don't have access to switch PCPs, that may reduce anxiety. But I 100% agree with everything K10 said. So Cindy from Brooklyn is training to be a therapist, wants to be able to serve the LGBTQIA community and build a niche practice for people who identify as such, as she does as well. What are your suggestions as to how to build up my practice, and what sort of support would I require as a gender-affirming therapist? Pod is awesome. Y'all are good people, and I love hearing the pod every week and learning new things.
Cindy, this is so great. Welcome to the field. This is so great. It just makes my heart happy when people want to support this community, because it's just – there's just so many beautiful people in this community. It's just – I'm privileged to be a part of it. But I do think that, you know, if you're trying to build a niche practice, I think the one question to ask yourself is what oversights might I have in my own biases? And I know it's not something we love to talk about, but it's something really important to assess and be aware of. Because Kristen, whatever we work with, people in this community, even as a bisexual human, I still have inherent biases that I have to acknowledge, you know, we all do. doesn't mean we're bad people, but those biases will inherently come out in your therapy sessions if you don't address those, you know? So I do think getting adequate supervision and getting training is definitely helpful. And really kind of pushing your own boundaries of like really thinking about case studies. That was one thing I did. I was looking at vignettes and case studies, and I would try to imagine myself in the room with someone and what knee-jerk reactions I might have about what they might tell me or what they might say. And, because that will come out in your facial expression inevitably. I mean, it just happens. So I think it's really important to like role play those things and stuff like that before you get into the room with a bunch of clients. It sounds like you'll be fine. But that's just mm-hmm. one thing that has helped for me. And it's challenging and it's uncomfortable. And you're just like, oh, I just want to love everybody. But I do think that there are parts of us that we're unwilling to maybe acknowledge. And I think that's part of being a therapist too, is to continually be in the space of not only lifelong learning, but really acknowledging and addressing those inherent biases that might come out in your therapy sessions, even if you have really good intentions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree. I would definitely say consultations, supervision, things like that. And going back to something KBI said earlier when talking about her old job, you know, with regard to like building up a practice, and K10 always puts this beautifully, like, you can present yourself as a safe space, but it's the client that gets to choose if you're a safe space. But from making sure your forms are, you know, inclusive of LGBTQ plus individuals, making sure your website, like, I know my office, I have like a bunch of pride flag stickers and other like just decorations up that the space, you know, welcomes mm-hmm. people as well, so that they know that you are. Because if it's not on, if that's going to be your niche and it's not abundantly clear, people may question if you are a safe space. But consultation, supervision.
yeah. Jess, I love that you said that, because I think that like I could think back to the therapists that I've seen and the ones who had like, you know, identifications, I was like, okay, cool, I could chill a little bit. Like just the minute you walk in the room, that's like a really good point. And then I think a lot of us do this anyway, but you know, when you meet a new client who, like really any client, I always tell them my pronouns, whether they're part of the community or not. I always say, I'm Dr. Casey, you can call me Kristen, my pronouns are she, her, what about you? And then they kind of can tell me whatever. And then I just say, okay, is that the name and pronouns that you want to be represented in your notes too? And I literally ask every single client, I don't care if they're assigned male at birth and they are cisgender and they tell me that. I ask everybody just because that's my clientele that I usually see. So something else that I thought of. So there's probably an endless list, but.
So Haley from Germany asked a question that I'm bringing up for KBI because she brought it up a little earlier. So Haley asked a couple questions, but the one I'm going to highlight, as a late diagnosed ADHDer, so autism, ADHD, who is questioning their gender identity, I find it fascinating that percentage-wise more autistic ADHDers and ADHDers are queer, genderqueer compared to the general population. Do you know why this is? Do you have any suspicion, some ideas why that might be? I'm very curious about your perspective. So for our group members at home, now that I awkwardly just passed that to KBI, her mic stopped working.
I think the universe is just like, you're sick, go home. Why'd you show up? Like, we loved having you regardless.
And typically, if Justin was here, we would have done some fancy editing, but he's not. So KBI is just going to be silent for the past couple minutes, but going back to Haley's wonderful question about neurodivergence and autism. So there is a lot of research coming out showing a correlation between autism and gender dysphoria. Showing that people with autism spectrum disorders may be more likely to experience gender dysphoria than non-autistic individuals. And additionally, gender diverse individuals are more likely to have autistic traits than cisgender individuals. However, why this is, we don't really know. So same for ADHD, like the theories I've at least seen. So there's a really good book called Gender Identity, Sexuality, and Autism by Eva Mendes and Meredith Maroney. Highly recommend it for anybody who is autistic and exploring their gender identity or clinician. It was really eye-opening for me. But I guess the leading theory for neurodiversity is that neurodivergent individuals usually are like predisposed to reject the rigidity of gender expectations placed on them by society. Like these individuals tend not to conform to societal norms in general, and that may cross over into gender expression. So if they already experience the world differently than neurotypicals and don't feel the need to conform to societal norms, they may be more likely to express or more open to express their gender. For autistic individuals specifically, they may feel so socially out of place, and this may tie into how they experience gender identity. So for example, like they may not identify with traditional gender roles, so they're more likely to or more willing to explore other gender identities. But really, we don't know why that is.
I thought I muted myself. We're having all these audio issues. That was such a good answer, Jess.
No problem. It is interesting because I was thinking about this. So I said a third of my caseload is trans or non-binary. I didn't actually look this up, but I would venture to guess at least half of my caseload that is trans or non-binary also is neurodivergent, either with autism, ADHD, or both.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, we got so many good questions. Unfortunately, we are at the end, but
I don't like
I know. It. Thank you all for submitting so many good questions. I wish we had more time, but you all probably don't want to hear us rambling for 2 hours.
I know. I know that we could all talk for 2 hours, probably even more about this. And yeah, I just want to thank everybody for tuning in today. And thanks for spending time with us talking about the whole concept of gender and the spectrum of it and what people might experience and some clinical applications and some definitions and stats. It was just so fun. And I know that this is not nearly an exhaustive list or an exhaustive, I don't know, session about gender in general. So that being said, send this to somebody who you think that might really, really love to hear us talk all about gender. And we will see you next week in group therapy. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Peace.